This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will discuss issues around nutrition in the older adult. The President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition paints a rather dim picture regarding the overall health of our nation. Among other things, less than 5% of adults spend 30 minutes in physical activity per day. Only 35 to 44% of adults 75 years or older are physically active. 90% of adults eat more sodium than recommended. From 1970 to 2008, the average daily calories have increased by 600, and 78 million adults are obese, with estimations of obesity-related illness annual costs approaching $190 billion. In the 2015 Clinics in Geriatric Medicine series on nutrition in older adults, the editor provided insights into how research is carving out this complex idea called nutrition. Cholecystokinin and leptin, nitric oxide, AMP kinase, frailty, sarcopenia, insulin resistance, and the benefit of specific diets. But the one term that we seem to still be perplexed about is this idea of malnutrition. How do we assess it? How do we treat it? And what should our goals be in its remediation, especially in the older adult population? Well, I can think of no one better to lead us through this discussion than that editor himself, a physician who has helped move the dial on our understanding of older adult nutrition for over 30 years. Renowned national and international leader in geriatrics, professor, researcher, and the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association, JAMDA, editor-in-chief emeritus, Dr. John Morley. And we're extremely fortunate to have Dr. Morley with us now. And Dr. Morley is a professor of medicine in geriatrics at St. Louis University. Dr. Morley, it is a pleasure to welcome you to AMDA On The Go.
It's wonderful to be with you guys today.
I'd also add for our listeners that for the first time in our podcast series, all the references come from the writings of our guest. Dr. Morley, I typically like to start the conversation with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework for discussion. In a 1986 article entitled Nutritional Status of the Elderly, you talked about lifespan and nutritional sparing, drew from nutrition research on other species, and you considered how nutrition could alter an aging immune or endocrine system. 30 years later, in a 2017 JAMDA article entitled Nutrition and Aging Well, considerations have obviously greatly evolved. You discussed the connection between diet, frailty, and sarcopenia, with specific human details now. And you concluded by saying that understanding nutrition and aging is beginning to emerge into the age of enlightenment. Can you tell us more about this age of enlightenment, perhaps framing it around the evolution and our understanding of the connection or relationship between nutrition and age, and why it has taken so long to become enlightened? Given what you know about older adults in our society today, where are we on this idea of nutritional competency?
Okay, so I think we've got to be very careful when we start looking at nutrition. We are more enlightened now than we were 30-odd years ago, but we have two pieces of nutrition. Nutrition is as it exists for people up to the age of 65, and then for as it exists for people over the age of 65. So a lot of the animals studies showed that dietary restriction would actually improve the outcome of younger animals. They would live longer, they would look healthier, they would do better. Similar sort of studies were done with monkeys as well as with mice and rats. So it seemed as if we could just maintain ourselves as relatively skinny people, we were going to do remarkable remarkably well. And I think that remains true for younger people. You don't want to be overweight, you want to exercise, and you want to do remarkably well at those things. But the problem is, as we get older, we run into the first big problem, which is weight loss becomes lethal. And there's now overwhelming evidence that people over the age of 65, even if they've got diabetes and are overweight and start to lose weight, they will have a poor outcome. Now, some of this is because they have treatable diseases or untreatable diseases. So they could have cancer or they could have gallbladder disease. Either one of these will kill you if it is not fixed. But the large proportion of this weight loss does not appear to be directly related to disease as being lethal, but rather the actual loss of weight. And there are lots of reasons why this may be the case. I mean, if you think about it, when you lose weight, you lose your muscle. When you lose your muscle, one of the things that happens is you get insulin resistance because you're losing your muscle receptors. But also, along with the loss of muscle, you lose bone. And as we're older, we're more likely to fall. And if we've got very little muscle and we've lost quite a lot of bone, we're going to fracture our hip. And we know that people who fracture their hip, about 20 to 30% of them are liable to die within the next year. In addition to that, as we're older and we lose weight, fat comes out of the fat cells, obviously, and normally when we're younger, it just goes out of the body. But when we're older, what happens is that fat has to travel around the blood vessels, and it looks around the blood vessels and it says, oh, here's a lovely little plaque. This looks just like the place I should settle down, and it tends to settle down in that place. So the big change that happens and has happened over the last 30 years is a real understanding that when you're older, protein energy under nutrition, which is normally weight loss, is very bad for you. And we have to recognize that. And that's particularly important when we get to long-term care. People living in a nursing home, weight loss is the single best indicator that they're liable to have a bad outcome. Now, along with this, we've got to recognize that our knowledge of what foods are good for us have also improved. And I think we recognize today what could be broadly characterized as a Mediterranean diet is extraordinarily good for people of all ages. It decreases heart disease, but it also stops some memory going away as much as it normally does with aging. And the Mediterranean diet, as we all know, consists really of vegetables, fruit, fish about three or four times a week, and a large amount of extra virgin olive oil. In studies we did in the laboratory, we showed that extra virgin olive oil will actually reverse memory deficits in an Alzheimer's mouse model. And there's been an excellent study, the PREDIMED, that was done in Spain, that showed if you increase the amount of extra virgin olive oil that Spaniards take in a day, up to about a liter a week, you will finish up getting less heart disease, and you will also get a better memory and less dementia. So we're in an exciting time. The other piece that I think we've got to remember is, you know, when I was growing up, we all thought that you take a vitamin a day. Somehow the doctor would tell you if you felt sick, you should take your vitamin. And we all thought this is a good thing. And many physicians have said to their patients, well, you don't look so good. Why don't you just take a multivitamin? But it turns out multivitamins have antioxidants in it. And antioxidants are basically great in very small doses. But when you take a multivitamin, what you do is you block the free radicals that are produced. And when you do that, the body says, I don't have free radicals. And you stop and say, well, does that matter? Well, yes, because God, being quite a lot brighter than human beings, or certainly men, basically gave us free radicals to protect us, first of all, from infections such as viruses and bacteria, but also from cancer. And if you wipe out those free radicals, the Cochrane meta-analysis has shown that you will actually finish up dying about 1% earlier than you would. So taking a multivitamin a day is about as bad for you if it's got antioxidants in it as as it is good for you to take a statin. So you can wipe out your effects of your statin by taking a multivitamin. So we've got to look and think carefully what we do as we get older. You mentioned at the beginning of this podcast about salt and how we know that too much salt is bad for us, but we've got to also recognize that the longest lived place in the world is in Japan, who take in about 4 to 5 grams of sodium a day, which is a huge amount compared to the recommended amounts. And really, the CDC recommended amount is too low for survival. You need to be closer to 3 grams a day for optimal survival. Now, if you've got heart disease, it may be useful to go ahead and reduce the sodium a little bit. But on the other hand, if you reduce it too much, the body doesn't function. So we keep on running into things that we thought were good for us that are not quite as good as we thought they were and can be tremendously lethal in nursing homes, which is why a number of years ago now, we actually published a number of papers pointing out that in nursing homes, even if you're a diabetic, you want to avoid any therapeutic diet. You want a good, healthy diet with adequate amounts of fruits and vegetables, ideally some fish in it and meat so that you have enough protein. And if you do all of those things, you need to maintain your weight and you will do very well indeed in the nursing home setting.
Well, Dr. Molly, let me extend this this discussion about nursing facilities. In my skilled nursing facility, when a nutrition consult does occur, invariably a resident is found to be protein deficient or is not taking enough calories, and a poorly tasting protein supplement is recommended, or a nutritional supplement for a diabetic is ordered, and that's it. In your 2015 article entitled Nutritional Supplementation and Sarcopenia, The Evidence Grows, you write about diabetes leading to accelerated sarcopenia, which I think you intimated earlier, and a provider's misguided fear of protein supplementation and renal failure. It seems to me that we are just not investing enough energy into understanding our residents' needs, assessing for frailty, or having adequate strategies to combat protein deficiency in general. What standardized, actionable steps should our, as I like to refer to them, Joe AMDAs, our practitioners in the skilled nursing trenches, be taking today at the minimum to assess and treat for nutritional inadequacy?
Well, I think the first thing we should be doing is we should be making sure that all of our friends who are living in a nursing home are actually not losing weight. So we should be monitoring weight very carefully, which is often done. It's there, but nobody looks at it to see if the person's losing weight. The second thing is, in any nursing home, you should have a diet that is suitable for everybody in the nursing home, and that means that you have to offer choices and you have to watch carefully if somebody isn't eating and find out why they're not eating. Has it got something to do with the fact that they don't like the food that they're getting given, or did they get sent to the nursing home on diet? And you're almost guaranteed, if somebody's just recently put you on a diet, to not like the food and start to lose weight. So the first thing is to try not to lose weight. What we've done in our nursing homes forever is actually had a nutrition cart go around, and it goes around twice a day between meals and offers food and liquids to the residents. Often done by a nurse's aide. The nurse's aide has a list of people who are losing weight, and it's particularly important that those people are offered any sort of snack. So what I like to tell people in the nursing home, there's no such thing as a bad food. So if you would like to have ice cream, if you want to have a milkshake, those are absolutely okay. And the best way to get protein or any food into you is getting it in as a total part of the menu. Now, we should be trying to get about 0.8 grams per kilogram of protein a day at a minimum. If we're losing muscle, maybe as much as 1 gram per kilogram per day. It's not that difficult and usually can be done in the diet, sometimes by adding a protein rich food to the diet that the person can use. However, if the person is becoming really sarcopenic and has lost a lot of muscle, at that stage they are going to need exercise, and when you start adding exercise, you may need to add to it a form of a protein supplement. The one we usually use is the leucine-enriched essential amino acid, though there are other ones out there, but that is the one with the best outcomes. And when you look at it, if you're going to give it to a person, we showed many years ago that you can't give it with a meal. And what you often see is the nursing staff will hand the patient the supplement just before their meal and say, finish this and then I'll bring you your meal. Well, if you're not eating well, you take in the protein and then you certainly don't feel like eating your meal, so you continue to lose weight. So it's very important that basically supplements, if you're going to use them, are given between meals. It's like having six meals a day instead of three or four meals a day. You keep on putting the supplements apart from the meal, an extremely important part of giving people supplements. It's really important in nursing home patients to look to see if they've got sarcopenia. Now, having said that, about in the studies we've just completed, about 70% of people in nursing homes have some degree of sarcopenia. We basically use the SARC-F screen, which is readily available at aging.slu.edu. It takes about 15 seconds to use. And if you do that and you find that the patient is in fact suggestive of having sarcopenia, it's very important that you get them into an exercise program first before you even start thinking of dietary intervention. So this basically means everybody in a nursing home needs to be in an exercise program. As you pointed out in the introduction, most older people don't like doing exercise. So how do you do this? Well, we have done this at NHC Maryland Heights extraordinarily successfully by basically having a lot of games that we get people to exercise in. So, for instance, we do dancing with the staffs, you know, not the stars, the staff. So once a week, we will have basically the staff go around into the different areas, and we will dance for 20 minutes with the different patients in the area. And 20 minutes is actually a lot of dancing for the staff to do sometimes, and certainly for the patients, and particularly our demented patients. But it works very nicely. The other thing that we did is we started Bingo Size. Bingo Size was started somewhere on the East Coast, and it's a wonderful idea. You basically mix in some exercise with your bingo, because everybody in the nursing home loves to go to bingo. I've never quite understood why anybody enjoys bingo, but they love it. And we started doing this, and then we got a complaint from the patient representatives, and they said, we don't want to do the exercise with bingo. And we thought, well, that's because it's no fun or something like that. And they said, no, that's not the problem. You're taking away the bingo time. So if you want to do the exercise, you've got to add an extra 15 minutes onto bingo time, and then you can do 15 minutes of exercise. And so that's what we did. So we always are looking for games that people can do, you know, anything that can keep people active. You know, you can do this with a Wii, and that has a number of games that people can play. But it's absolutely essential if somebody is losing muscle to have an exercise component. And then they should be eating a very solid diet, ideally with enough protein in. Only when they are not having enough protein do you add a protein supplement. And that's the time to add the protein supplement. But, you know, you need to be careful, think about it, and intervene. No one in the nursing home is going to make a true diagnosis of sarcopenia at the moment. That requires doing a DEXA, doing a walking speed, a grip strength. And there's just not enough time to do it, and it doesn't get done. Now, you know, other exercise groups, again, can be done. It doesn't all have to be fun. It can be doing exercise. If you have an exercise therapist in your nursing home, they can make exercise amazingly a large amount of fun. Down in Perry County, about 100 miles south of St. Louis, we have a set of exercise groups for people with sarcopenia. They have 16 groups a week for a population, where the old population is 3,200. 150. And basically, people love going to these exercise groups, either in the nursing home or out in the community. And they do remarkably well. I go down there quite often because it's part of our GWEP grant. And basically, when I go down there, I always join in the exercise group. I'm 73. I think I can easily handle these 88-year-olds. And about two-thirds of the way through, the exercise therapist taps me on the shoulder and looks at me and says, you know, you really need an exercise therapist. And she's absolutely right, because the 88-year-olds are doing far better than I'm doing. And you can't get into these groups unless you A, had sarcopenia, and B, were falling. So, you know, we've got to recognize we don't always realize old people can do this exercise, and we don't push them to do it. If you make the mistake of going into hospital, you will lose basically a kilogram of muscle within the first 3 days that you're in hospital. And that's like losing a quadriceps. Mikel Izquierdo, who now is who is in Spain, he used to be the coach for Liverpool soccer team and then for the Barca soccer team. And when his wife said, you either come home with the kids or you're basically finished, he basically joined a physical therapy program, brought in exercise therapists, had no idea that people couldn't just work as hard as the best soccer players in the world. And he recently published his studies with exercise therapists in hospitals showing that if you get exercise twice a day, 10 minutes twice a day, you actually have much better outcomes and you think better. So exercise is key. Getting adequate amounts of calories and adequate amounts of protein are the extra part. And at all times, we've got to watch that basically these patients are not losing weight, that they're active and they're having fun. And I think, you know, basically all activities in nursing homes should be meaningful, because it's meaningful activities that make a difference. And again, if you go to our aging.slu.edu site, there is actually a wonderful video there of showing all the different meaningful activities that we have done at NHC Maryland Heights. So they are easy things to do, but everybody can come up with their own ideas of what is fun. And I think it's putting the exercise with the nutrition, making sure it's a balanced diet, making sure that the equivalent of some extra virgin olive oil is available a lot. And, you know, basically patients can and do like olive oil. It actually flavor enhances almost every food. So I think putting those things together, you will see that the average resident in a nursing home is going to, one, be happier, two, is going to have much less muscle wasting, and three, is going to think better. And that's what the whole joy of working in a nursing home is not taking things away from people, but giving them things that make their life more meaningful.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, the only foundation dedicated to advancing the field and practice of post-acute and long-term care medicine. Our foundation is totally unique in focusing on issues of competence, quality, and the value we bring to patients in this setting. Please support the foundation at paltcfoundation.org.
We're having a wonderful discussion with Dr. John Morley about issues around nutrition in the older adult. Dr. Morley, to extend from our last question, in 2010, you were the first author of an article entitled Nutritional Recommendations for the Management of Sarcopenia, many of which you've already discussed, which was developed from a 2008 consensus conference of the Society of Sarcopenia, Cachexia, and Wasting Disorders. Among the recommendations for various anabolic strategies, some of which you've already commented on, was the comment, aging is associated with physiologic anorexia, decreased calorie intake, and weight loss, which in turn is associated with a decline in muscle mass and increased mortality. We seem to now have a consensus on definition, and you've just given us a bunch of strategies, yet it seems that strategies continue to emerge. Why are we still needing to talk about ways in which to combat sarcopenia? Do we think that we'll be able to negate the consequences of normal aging through a nutritional magic bullet or a magic bullet strategy? Is there some missing piece to this nutrition and aging puzzle that we still have yet to find?
Well, then missing piece, I think I've already alluded to, it's sure. The big E word. You know, exercise is the key to keeping muscle intact and then giving adequate calories and adequate protein to maintain it. Realistically, as you said again in the introduction, that there are very few people who keep up with exercise. And so exercise is our starting point. And, you know, you, like me, have been in many nursing homes, and I'm sure you recognize that maintaining an exercise program for all the residents in a nursing home is extremely hard. And if, as the medical director, you stop looking, they disappear at the speed of light. I mean, it took forever for me to keep bingo size in, and they were all ready to drop it when the residents said they didn't want it. You know, Dancing with the Stars works wonderfully if I go in, and every time I'm in, I say, oh, isn't it time to do Dancing with the Stars? You know, these are extra things that people don't necessarily realize are the center to good care in a nursing home. Nursing homes employ a physical therapist. They think the physical therapist will do all of this, but physical therapists do a modicum of exercise normally. They don't do anything like what is the amount of exercise that is needed by our residents in the nursing home or by old people at home or even in the hospital. Most of our physical therapists in the hospital get people out of bed if you're really lucky, and they may walk them to the toilet or sort of 20 steps or so and put them back in bed. That is not exercise, and we really have to recognize that the E word is the beginning and the most important part of it. Where necessary, some form of essential amino acid supplementation with leucine. Leucine switches on mTOR, and mTOR drives protein into the muscle, so that's why that's important, are absolutely key. A number of years ago, I would have told you vitamin D is also key, but we're starting to recognize now that vitamin D was one of these false facts that was sold to an excessive amount to people dealing with older people. It turns out that most of the studies with vitamin D look at people who've got some illness. If you've got an illness, what happens is you basically finish up not going out in the sun. If you don't go out in the sun, your vitamin D levels go down. So sick people always have lowish vitamin D. Ian Reid in New Zealand many years ago showed that if you take somebody in a nursing home and you basically just take them outside 30 minutes a day. Now, New Zealand is very far south, and actually there's not a lot of sun in New Zealand much of the year. But if you do that, you can normalize the vitamin D. We also have learned that the level of vitamin D, when you measure it, that 25-hydroxy-D that we all got used to measuring, is actually most probably a not very useful measurement of vitamin D. It turns out that it may be okay if you've got a really white skin, but if you happen to be a Tamil Indian, if you happen to live in Indonesia, if you happen to be Chinese, or an African American, basically your dark skin has allowed you to develop a totally different circulating level of vitamin D that is normal. So your bioavailable vitamin D is much lower in those populations. We don't have good measurements for bioavailable vitamin D. So most of our patients in nursing homes need to get out in the sun, and they need to do some exercise and walk out in the sun. They don't necessarily need vitamin D. If your values are extraordinarily low, and I'm not recommending you measure them, but obviously somebody, for instance, who's had a hip fracture, they may be very useful to basically give them some vitamin D. But again, the amount you need of vitamin D is not the 50,000 a week or 2,000 to 4,000 a day. It's somewhere less than 1,000 international units a day. And I think that's one of the things. It's a little bit like giving a vitamin to everybody. We thought it was good, we give more, and then actually it doesn't necessarily work well. And everybody's throwing up their hands in horror and says, well, if I give vitamin D, it doesn't do any harm. Well, vitamin D pushes up calcium, and we tend to forget that basically calcium is important to the function of our body. And we need to keep that value of calcium in our blood at a very, very reasonable level. It can't go too high, it can't go too low. And we've shown that when you give people calcium, and if you follow the recommendations of giving an extra gram and a half a day, you are going to eventually give that person a myocardial infarction, you're going to make them constipated, and also you're going to make them slightly more demented. So all of the things we thought are good if you have about a gram of calcium a day. But when you start to add more than that, you start to run into problems. And the first problem is constipation. And we all know that in nursing homes, our patients are constipated. If you give too much vitamin D along with too much calcium, you're going to have constipation, you're going to have myocardial infarctions, and you're going to have an increased rate of dementia. So the world changes around us. And I think it's very important to realize that. And I think, you know, the same thing is true with the glucose levels now. As we look at it, we thought that you should get glucose, or at least the hemoglobin A1C, down to about 6. The problem in nursing homes when you do that is most of your patients have hyperglycemic episodes. And we know now that the recommended hemoglobin A1C for people in nursing homes is between 7 to 8, which is much higher. So all of what we thought were nutritional pearls when I was growing up and started out as an endocrinologist, these are all being dissipated and saying, you know, let's do things in a modicum where it's necessary, but don't try and add a bit more, because more is good for you. The only place that more seems good for you in a nursing home is when basically you are losing weight, when as much food as you can eat is good for you. I think everybody knows that we came out many years ago with a Meals on Wheels mnemonic for treatable causes of weight loss in nursing homes. And you've always got to look for those treatable causes, things like medications, emotional, that's basically depression in particular, most probably the most major cause of anorexia and weight loss in the nursing home. But you can get what we've called anorexia tardive. This is when people get older, they start to just not feel like eating as much, and you've got to push them to some extent. I've had a patient with late life paranoia who stood at the door all the time because they thought somebody was going to steal their pot plants, and she kept on opening it and didn't eat. She was losing weight, and one of the few times in my life where an antipsychotic was really useful was in her, because once we gave it to her, she stopped worrying about the kids in the neighborhood who weren't coming by and put on weight. Swallowing problems. We've got to always think of dysphagia. We talk about sarcopenia. Everybody who's got sarcopenia now is becoming very apparent they also have dysphagia, and using the EAT-10 questionnaire and looking for dysphagia is important. The other reason is important is now we've got the new rules in the nursing home about the acuity. And if we pick up somebody who's got sarcopenia using the SARC-F, that has an ICD-10 code to increase the acuity, and therefore they can have longer physical therapy. But in addition to that, if you do an EAT-10 and you find that they've got dysphagia, that will mean that they should also get speech therapy. Now, speech therapy doesn't mean having somebody come in and give thickened liquids. Thickened liquids are horrible, inedible most of the time. And what it really means is you've got to start doing tongue exercises. And there is actually a sort of barbell created to do tongue exercises, which is a lot of fun to play with. So these are things that we can do. And as we go on beyond the swallowing, we go to oral factors, and oral frailty is becoming very common at this moment in time. And we need to have a dentist make sure that the person's teeth are working okay. Nosocomial infections can often cause weight loss. And then we get to that's the meals on. W is wandering and other dementia-related behaviors. H are for all the endocrine disorders, hyperthyroidism, hypercalcemia, hypertension due to pheochromocytoma, or hypoadrenalism, all can cause weight loss. E is for enteric problems. This is like the celiac disease we've got to be aware of. That's often late onset. The next E is eating problems. The person with a tremor who can't get food to their mouth. My favorite patient was a patient who fundamentally was eating 3,000 calories a day and losing weight. When I went in to watch the patient eating, it turned out that the sheets were eating about 2,600 calories a day because he had such a tremor. We gave him a heavy-handed spoon. Today you can get wonderful electronic robotic spoons that will get the food to your mouth and got better. So then we come to the L, and that's for basically any intervention, any therapeutic diet, so low-calorie diets for diabetes and so on. And then the S is for stones, cholecystitis. When I had gallbladder disease, I lost 70 pounds in 7 weeks because I didn't trust any surgeon to come and take it out. So I kept on looking for a better surgeon. Now, you know, this is stupid. I understand it. But on the other hand, I'm sure all physicians out there recognize that some surgeons are much better than others. Just finding the right one shouldn't take you 7 weeks. So this is the approach that we do, and I think it's important to put it all together. And when we do that, we suddenly start to realize that much of what we've been taught is not quite right. None of it is wrong. It's just not quite right. And as people get older and up into their 90s, a lot of it is less right than it was when you were 35.
Dr. Morley, as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I typically try to be somewhat provocative with my guest, but not too much so. And this has been such a wonderful conversation, I don't want to be too much so at all. In 2016, you and artist Amanda Taylor presented a JAMDA article entitled, "Is It Time to Retire Santa Claus?" Does this sound familiar to you?
It sounds very familiar. First of all, shout out for Amanda Taylor, who's my granddaughter. She did the artwork, so that was the best part of the article. Okay, but, you know, if you think of it, Santa Claus is the epitome of what we don't want our children to do. We don't want them to overeat, and, you know, Santa Claus goes around, he comes down the chimney in every house, and people put out food for him, so he has to eat all this food. I know when I was young, the food disappeared from next to the chimney or the tree. He is always seen smoking. He basically is always seen drinking in the pictures. He's enormously overweight. He almost certainly has obese sarcopenia because he falls down the chimney. And, you know, falling is terrible for old people. So when we start looking at it, you know, he's got all these problems. He's got visceral obesity, and we know visceral obesity is associated with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. He is the epitome of a poorly nourished middle-aged person. And now, if he was 95, I would say if he wasn't smoking, that would be nice, and he could have one glass of red wine a day, and he would be fine. But we are teaching our children, their role model is just what you don't want children and young adults to think of as the right role model for nutrition. So we wrote that as a Christmas piece in JAMDA because I thought it would be a lot of fun to collaborate with my granddaughter, but also just fun at pointing out that sometimes the role models we show people are not the right role models. And, you know, when we look at older people, we do exactly the opposite. We try and find an extraordinarily healthy, extraordinarily muscular, skinny older person. As you get older, you would like to be a little bit overweight, and it turns out that death when your BMI is somewhere between 26 to about 35 is actually a straight line. You don't have that increase that you see when you're younger as you get fat. So realistically, Santa Claus may be an okay model for a 90-year-old, though one or two things still wouldn't be perfect. But it's a terrible model to put out there for our children. And as grandparents, which most of us are, and those of us who are ready to go into nursing homes definitely are, we don't want to be teaching our children to be Santa Claus.
We have been so privileged to speak with and learn from Dr. John Morley, probably the only person in the world who has the clout to criticize Santa Claus. Dr. Morley.
And it is Christmas time.
Dr. Morley, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA on the go.
It was a great pleasure. I hope people enjoy it. If they have any questions, they can go to aging.slu.edu. The questions will come to me, and I'm more than happy to answer them. And if they have disagreements, I love arguing. So anytime they want, that would be great.
Thank you, Dr. Morley. References for this podcast can be found at paltc.org/podcast, and look for the name Morley because it's on all the references. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
We thank you for your support in 2019 and your continued support in 2020. Please visit the Foundation website, paltcfoundation.org, to learn more about donation opportunities. And make sure to visit the Foundation booth at the annual conference in Chicago this April. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast's title. Thank you.